if it had been even slightly more icy, it could have been bad. And there was no reason for it. But I was really steamed about that. And the reason was, is because several times in the week before, this has happened to me. This happens a lot. People are just so impatient. And I get it. I get it. I understand. You're sitting there, and you're trying to look around the snowbank, and you're trying to get out in the traffic, and it just does, it seems never ending, right? You just can't get out, right? You're sitting in Pino's, and you're trying to get out. You can't. You're sitting trying to get out of Walmart on Second Line and go left, right, down. Can't get out there. And so people, I think, just go. They just get frustrated and go. And I'm not, I don't feel I'm normally an angry driver. But I was steamed. And prior to that, that day, I had gotten an email from someone who represents a service that we pay for. And all the emails I've ever gotten from this person have been complaints about how we use their service. And I'm really hating people. See, I would never call myself a pastor because I take that term very seriously. I think pastors are supposed to have a love for people. And generally, for me, I don't like people. I have an intolerance for what I feel as stupidity. I have an intolerance for me when it looks like people have not thought things through, which is getting more and more often. Why? It's because I keep getting older, and a lot of the people I keep coming into contact with are younger, and that's just the way it is, right? It's just the way it is. Young people just don't think things through. But that doesn't help me at all. And then you read this. But I say to you who hear, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who abuse you. To the one who strikes you on the cheek, offer the other also. And from the one who takes away your cloak, do not withhold your tunic either. Was that hard to understand? Do we really need to dig into that too much? Do we have to do some word studies? And yet, I submit to you, this is one of the hardest commandments to follow. We all cerebrally, if we call ourselves Christian, all cerebrally subscribe to this. Yes, absolutely, this is what we should be doing. But on a day-to-day basis, when that idiot cuts you off in traffic, or you get the 10th email from that whiner who has no face, how hard is this? And that, my friends, these are just faceless entities too, really. I couldn't even tell you what the person, I could tell you what the color of the car was. I could tell you there was an SUV, and I could tell you that it was white, but I didn't even really see the person. What about those who have faces that we know about? Who is your enemy? The Jews in Jesus' day, they spent an awful lot of time thinking about these sorts of things, because this isn't new stuff, really. A lot of this language is taken out of Leviticus. But there the language seems to be more focused on the community and what to do for your community within your community. And for Jews in Jesus' day and throughout the centuries before that, they were very careful about keeping the law in that regard and making sure that their brother in the family of Jacob fellow Israelites, they were taken care of, that they didn't do certain things to them. It was a crime to lend money for interest to a brother Israelite. When you're in business, remember you had to, if you recall this from the law, if you had a field, and almost everybody did, you weren't to glean, or you weren't to harvest right to the edges, so you as to leave food for the poor in your community. And you were to do these things. You were to love them, do good to them. But what about those that weren't part of God's family? Because that's how they considered themselves. They were family, right? They could trace their lineage back to Abraham. They were all part of a tribal network. That was all family. And for so many years, God said, this is how I've chosen you from among the nations. And I'll be your God, and you will be my people, and you will do what I say. And you will worship me, and you will look to me for all your needs, and no other. You will not worship the gods of the nations who are around you, all those others, all the nations, Gentiles, from the Greek, sinners, in the colloquial, sinners, anybody who was outside. What about them? And Jesus taught some interesting stories, right? And what's the one that's in your mind right now? The Samaritan, the Good Samaritan. About someone who was outside that family, who seemed to show a lot more neighborliness. But they've been talking about this. Who is my neighbor? Who is my neighbor? Because if we can define who the neighbor is, then we can focus our energies and the law, the things that we're supposed to do, upon that neighbor and no one else. But now Jesus is taking all that language and he's flipping it upside down and he's saying, love your enemies. Who are their enemies? Samaritans? Yeah. Romans, absolutely. When they thought of enemies, they were thinking of their alien overlords. And they'd been under that thumb for a long time. And before them, it was somebody else. And before them, it was somebody else, stretching right back to Babylon. Those were the enemies. And when Jesus says, love your enemies, that's exactly who pops into their heads. Now, it's interesting, if you look at this parallel passage in Matthew, Matthew's talking more to a Jewish audience. Luke, of course, is talking to a Gentile audience. So there's differences in language and focus. And Luke is not going to use language that Gentiles wouldn't understand, but Matthew kind of, he gets a bit more specific and says sinners and tax collectors specifically, which would have meant nothing to a Gentile reader. But Gentile hearers, readers, they would understand sinners because everybody at this time, whether you were worshiping the God of Israel, Yahweh, you were worshiping something. You're worshiping a god. You're worshiping a deity. And those, and that kind of behavior that was contrary to what your whatever you worshipped, if you did behavior that was contrary to what they wanted, that was sin. So they understood sin. They understood sinners. Contrary to our culture, of course, where sin is a weird word. Like, what is that? Right and wrong? According to who? According to what? There is no standard. Nobody in our culture understands. Less and less people are understanding what sin is and who sinners are. If you do it, it must be right because you wanted to do it, right? That's how some of my children define it. Why did you do that? I wanted to. But Jesus, in case there was any ambiguity about who your enemy was, he defines it, right? those who hate you, those who curse you, those who abuse you? And then what action should we take to this sort of, to these people that do these things? I mean, does that leave anything out? Abuse? Cursing? Does that leave anybody out? Is there anybody that we might not safely not love because they don't fit into these categories? I think that's pretty all-embracing, actually. What do we do? To the one who strikes you on the cheek, offer the other. Who does that in our culture today? Almost nobody. And there are certain cultures to which you're taking your life in your hands to do so. To strike someone in the face is to cause that other person to lose face. And then they're going to spend the rest of their life trying to gain it back at your expense. I'm not sure that's as hard-coded into our culture, but you know what? We have an awful lot of that. To the one who takes away your cloak, do not withhold your tunic either. How many times have we been robbed in a multitude of ways? In a multitude of ways, people have taken and not given back, and that just eats away. Give. Now we turn to the positive. Give to anyone who begs from you, and from one who takes away your goods, do not demand them back. Jews were allowed, this is interesting, Jews were allowed, not allowed to lend money at interest to fellow Israelites, but they were, according to the law, allowed to lend money to anybody else at interest, at whatever they wanted, of course. And that's been the case for centuries. But now Jesus is saying the opposite, right? If you lend something out, money or otherwise, or do we expect it back? No. And not even with interest. Interest is like, pfft, don't even think about that. How does a world work like that? That's okay. You can ask yourself that. How is a world to work like that? Think about the hard questions. And then here's the golden rule. And as you wish that others would do to you, do so to them. Oh, we love this. We love to teach our children this. They're still teaching it in our public schools, of all things. Isn't that wonderful? I got two tickets. No, Elliot did. Elliot got two tickets. I just happened to be the one who gets to go with him because he showed good character at school. Because he'll pick up garbage. So, I mean, there's still an element in our public schools where this sort of behavior is encouraged. And yet everything else in our society is sort of teaching the opposite. Them that has the gold makes the rules. That's our world. And now Jesus removes even more ambiguity. If you love those who love you, so what? So what? Everybody else does that too. The sinners do that. And if you lend to those from whom you expect to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. So he's saying, you might pat yourself on the back because you are giving to those who ask because you like them or because you expect to get it back. But that's nothing. That's a zero-sum game. You've got nothing. You come out not ahead. You are right where you've been all this time. Because even everybody does that. Everybody does that. There's no credit. You get no credit, no points. But why? Why would we do this? Why would we do such a radical thing? And believe me, it is radical. To love your enemy, truly, that's a radical thing. But why? Why would you do such a thing? And there have been, Christians have been wrestling with this for centuries. They started writing about it right off the bat. You look at the early church fathers, they were examining these passages. And they were discussing who's an enemy, who's a friend. What was the meaning here? Why? Because your reward will be great. We're down in verse 35 now. And you will be sons of the Most High. For he is kind to the ungrateful and the evil. Be merciful, even as your Father is merciful. Sons of the Most High. That's language right out of the Old Testament. And what it would have invoked was, sons of the Most High was most often used in the Old Testament for God's divine counsel. Those divine beings that he surrounded himself with and that were a part of his family. It was sons, right? It was filial language. This is my family. And I've made them to be part of my family, and they will be my sons, and I will be their father. And he created people to be part of that family. So what is Jesus saying here? If you do these things, if you love your enemy, then you will be what you were supposed to be. You will actually be imaging your Creator. And isn't that why we were created? He created them in the image of God, to image the Creator to the rest of creation. This is what God looks like. This is what God does. Right? Because God is merciful. Your Father is merciful. And what we seem to keep forgetting is that we are only here, and we only are what we are because of the mercy of God. We ourselves. Paul points it out in Romans chapter 5. When did God love us? When we were still enemies of God. While we were still his enemies, there was no interim period where we thought, oh, following God might be a good idea. Let's explore that option. No. Actively against God, he loved us then. And it's because of the love of God that we're drawn to God. Now, is there supposed to be some ulterior motive where we love our enemies so that they come to God? Is that the point of it? Well, that might be a result, but it also might not be. So if you love your enemy and they fail, and they don't get drawn to you and to God, have you failed? Is it all for nothing? No. Because you are still imaging God. That is what God is like. God continues to show mercy. He continues to love his enemies. And sons of the Most High will continue to do the same thing. Constantly. Without ceasing. And that is hard. For me, I mean, to say to be like Jesus, that is a big, broad brush. Because Jesus is God, right? And God is just, the fish was this big, you know? But one of the things for me that defines Jesus most clearly in my mind at this point in my life is this, is that he loves enemies. And maybe that it is clear and it sticks out right now because I don't. I'm not very good at it. And so I see that sharp distinction between me and Jesus. And yet I want to be that. Love continues to show itself in its reluctance to judge. Judge not, and you will not be judged. Condemn not, and you will not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven. Give, and it will be given to you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be put into your lap. For with the measure you use, it will be measured back to you. We love this verse, eh? Everybody loves this verse. Because it's the get-out-of-jail-free card, it seems. Don't judge me, because you'll be judged. Everybody loves to recite this one. When anybody calls into account any kind of question about their behavior, we all like this. We like this one. And one of the most popular ways of turning around an argument, of course, especially within family, because we know each other so well, is to say, well, what about that time you did the exact same thing? What right of you to tell me? And there's really no resolving this issue. But what is Jesus saying when he says, don't judge? I don't know. I'm going to give it a go, though. What judging does is it distances ourselves and cuts us off from the judged. And in this whole context, what Jesus seems to be wanting those that are sons of God to do and be is to close the gap. And we want the gap to be open in our behavior. We want there to be a gap. And if the judged are faithless, so much the better. Then we can, with impunity, call all sorts of hellfire and brimstone down upon those that are doing wrong. And it gives us the superior moral high ground, right? And what Jesus is saying here, and he fleshes it out towards the end of this paragraph, is that there's really no one. No one has the moral high ground. None of us has the moral high ground. And when you judge whoever, you are opening up the gap that God is seeking to close because he wants to come near. And those that are his need to come near. And when you are near, and when you are in close, and when you are embracing, the judge might be doing wrong. That is true. But what is your attitude? Jesus, there was a story. There's a story in John chapter 7 where this crowd of bullies drags this woman before Jesus who was caught in adultery. You can only imagine what that must have been like. So they drag her out and they say, this woman was caught in adultery. What is your judgment? You know the story. What did Jesus do? Was she in the wrong? Let's just cut through to the chase. Was she in the wrong? Yep. Sure was. Absolutely. But Jesus refused to condemn her. And when it was just her and him together, because everybody else had slunk off, he says, I don't condemn you. Go and sin no more. How do we think that we are any better than that? How do we feel that we have the right to judge any more than what Jesus did? And yet we do it all the time. Every day, we're pointing the finger from the moral high ground. Jesus wants us to come near. He wants us to close the gap. He wants us not to condemn. But he recognizes sin. He calls it what it is. And that's okay. But there's this to be this attitude of love too. Love is not tolerance. That's what the world wants us. They want us to say it's okay. They want us, there is no black and white. There is no right and wrong. That's what our society prefers. That's how they live. Say, oh well, that's working. But there's a huge difference between love and tolerance. And then he goes on and he tells a parable. And it has to do with this whole judging thing. And he's talking about, he tells two parables that both have to do with seeing. One has to do with the blind leading the blind. And it's supposed to be ridiculous, right? These stories that he tells, they're both sort of ridiculous if you actually thought about it. We've thought about it and heard it so often that the ridiculousness of it seems to have evaded us. But think of it afresh again, right? The blind leading the blind. It is, you know, it's sort of a cliche now, but this is where it came from. But it is a ridiculous thing. Who would do that? But it has to do with picking the right teachers. Who's teaching who? Be careful, he's saying. And then along the lines of judgment about the speck and the beam or the log in your own eye. Everybody's familiar, of course, with something, you know, there's something in my eye. Oh, let me see, right? And you're looking, and usually it's hard to see it, but usually it's an eyelash or something. But the log, that log imagery, that's something else. You know, you can imagine that sticking out of your face. But the ridiculousness is supposed to help you focus and think about just how ridiculous it would be to act in this way. And it's the same thing when hypocrites are pointing out, they're judging and saying, look at what you're doing. And at the same time, there's something even worse going on in their own lives. Don't be like that, he's saying. And then he answers the question on how can you tell then? How can you tell? The Jews of Jesus' day, and even the Gentiles to whom Luke was writing, they were concerned with what does it look like? What do people look like who are following a certain path? For the Jews in particular, they had procedures. They actually had clothing that was worn that marked them out as children of Abraham, as followers of Yahweh, ostensibly, right? Tassels and so on. And even today, there's Jews that physically mark themselves out so everybody knows they are in this way. And they're concerned about that. And we're still concerned about that. We are. What does a Christian look like? I heard a story from a friend of mine who was of Irish origin, and he went to visit his folks. Never met them before. He was it was sort of a brave thing of him to do, but he went back to Ireland. He'd never been to Ireland, so it's funny to say he went back to Ireland. But he went to Ireland for the first time, and he was looking up his roots, and he found family, and they received him as a long-lost son, very hospitable, and he ended up staying with some distant relative, and he had recently become a Christian, and he was used to going to church, and she was going to go to church too, so it was a Sunday, and he was hitchhiking, okay? He was hitchhiking through Ireland and therefore had not a whole lot on him, backpack, basically. So he comes down in his cleanest jeans and a t-shirt. And Irish, old Irish Christian ladies. What are you wearing? Well, this is what I got to wear to church. Ah, well, you'll not be wearing that to meeting. This is all I've got. I'm backpacking. I just have, you know, they're clean jeans and a t-shirt. You'll not be wearing that to meeting. At our meetings, the men wear navy blue suits and a navy blue tie and a white shirt. She lent him some to make sure that he fit in. But we still, and that might be an extreme example, but I would argue that we are still concerned about what does it look like? What do we sound like? And I think Jesus cuts to the mustard. Is that the right expression? Cuts to the chase? Something about mustard. Anyway, trees. Good trees don't bear bad fruit, and bad trees don't bear good fruit. That's it. What does a Christian look like? What does a child, a son of God, look like? They bear good fruit. Whatever they look like, whatever the hairstyle is, however many things they have in their nose, whatever music they like to listen to, good fruit is evidence of a good tree. That's hard. That's sort of hard to get our head around. But there it is. We live in a society where it seems to be very popular, especially to the south of us, especially if you gain any kind of notoriety or money, to stand on a stage, point heavy words, and thank God for your success. Oh, they're Christians. Well, isn't that wonderful? Just because a mouse is on a cookie sheet in the oven doesn't make it a cookie. What do these people do? What is their fruit? And it's not just, and here I'm going to start treading on toes, maybe. It's not just celebrities. What about them politicians? Oh, so-and-so is a Christian. We have to get behind them and support their policies. Do we? What if those policies are resulting in the worst atrocities of our century? What if those policies are taking away things that should not be taken away from the people that own them? And if those people get upset because our policies are taking away things and they fight back, is it right to go and bomb the hell out of them? Is that good fruit? A tree is known by its fruit. And then he just calls a spade. Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I tell you? And I hear this all the time. And this meant something in the first century. When you called someone Lord, Kyrios. In the Roman Empire, there was one. And you know who that was? Caesar. Caesar was Lord. And you owed everything to that guy. And your Lord, whoever you called Lord, you owed them allegiance. You owed them your respect. You owed them your obedience. And Jesus is saying, how ridiculous is it for you to say that to me and then don't do what I tell you? I have this issue at home all the time. I am your father. You call me daddy. And yet you just did what I told you not to do. Or you didn't do what I asked you to do. You know how it is. We're all familiar with this. And yet we do it with God all the time. The Lord Jesus. If Jesus is Lord, then you do what he asks. John fleshes this out in his epistle in 1 John. And then, of course, the very familiar house on rock. Wise man, foolish man. We're familiar with this from Sunday school, if you went to Sunday school. But here's a little nuance for you, possibly. We tend to think of the building, the house that's being built on the good foundation of Jesus' words and actually doing it. That's what he's saying. If you hear it and you do what I tell you, then you're like a man who builds a house on a rock. And then, when there is trouble, you stay firm, as opposed to building on sand where it's not firm. And the foundations wash away. There's no foundation. We tend to think of that in a very individualized sense, where we are personally building our own house, our own philosophy on life, our own relationship with God personally. I would suggest to you, while that is not the case, that's true, but for the hearers and the readers of this gospel, it was a little bit bigger than that. When they heard the word house, for Jews in particular, they would have also heard temple, because quite often in the Old Testament, the temple, tabernacle, was referred to as the house of God. And even for Luke's Gentile hearers, house would have evoked not just an individual life, but house generally referred to those associated with you. Your house. When you talked about your house, you weren't talking about your address. You were talking about everybody that was in it. And that could be extensive, depending on who you were. House was your community. For the Jews, house was the place where you worshiped and the people whom you worshiped with. And I feel that's what they would have been thinking of, because when Jesus describes the fall of the house that is not built on a good foundation, the fall is great. The fall is great. If it's just little individual houses that are falling because we're not listening to Jesus, I'm not sure that it would have been described as great. But houses, communities, families, objects of worship that are built on nothing, when they fall, it's great. And our culture has built houses. We've built houses in our communities, in our culture, that are not built on Jesus' teachings. And we've seen them fall. And memory is selective. We tend to forget those falls. And we keep building, but it's all coming down. We can argue, and Christians before us have argued, and tried to limit the scope of Jesus' teaching, particularly the one about loving your enemies. We can argue that Jesus didn't understand what it was to run a country, in which case you have to limit your scope of who enemy is. Really? Jesus doesn't know what it's like to run a country? But he's Lord of the universe. It's a hard one. But let me ask you something. What would it look like if we actually truly, despite the odds, despite the roadblocks, loved our enemies. And you know who they are. Jesus didn't define them for us because he knew you could define it yourself very well. Who are the enemies? And if we love them, if we just love them, if we were like Jesus and we loved them, what would the world look like? If that permeated into our institutions, our politics, what would the world look like? It was radical in Jesus' day. It's still radical. And I talk to you today as one, I'm not telling you that I've got the moral high ground, because I don't. I told you, well, I'm terrible. But I want this. Because I think, and I know, it was intended to change the world. Father, we thank you for your word today. We thank you for the hearts and minds. We thank you for all the hearts and minds that have struggled with your words. Easy to understand, so hard to implement. And Lord, I would even offer up and submit that this is impossible to do on our own. We need your power. But help us be prepared for when we ask for the power to love our enemies, that we'd be willing to receive it. Because that's scary. These things we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.